I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Great joy today to welcome Dr. Ben Holtberg, a faculty member at Fuller and faculty associate professor of human development in our School of Psychology, to Conversing. Ben, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I've loved the fact that you're at Fuller, and there's many reasons for that, but one of them is that you're a person who I think exists at an intersection of many different kinds. I see it as a great gift because of the intersection of how important physical integration with mental health converges, with how the church converges with concerns of whole person development and with issues of identity that are psychological, but they're also sociological. And as you know from your research, they can be so deeply related to performance. Those are all parts of the intersection that you and your work live at. And I love that. It makes me feel personally just grateful that you're on the faculty, but excited because it feels to me like that's partly what Fuller is always trying to do, is to live at an intersection, an important intersection. So tell us how you got to this intersection. What's your background? How did it happen that you eventually came to be in this role at Fuller? Because in a way, it's a stacking up of many different layers of experience and formal education.
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town, Salina, Kansas. And, you know, part of my life from as early as I can remember was sports. I remember being at recess and they had a contest of who could do the most laps. And I remember just running longer than people. And I remember that experience and that joy that I had just going out and playing. And so, you know, sports was always kind of a part of my life. I grew up in a pastor's home, and my dad is still a pastor at the same church almost 40 years.
Wow.
And so we had an incredible support system. But I also saw my dad sacrifice a lot to pastor, and he started the church. And so part of my story coming up was we didn't really have much when it came to materials, but we had a lot of relationships. And the gift that I was given growing up was just growing up in neighborhoods that were diverse and with kids from all over the place in this small town of Salina, Kansas, of all places. But I learned really early that I just loved just being a part of something with people in sports or at church. My dad, you know, he was working a night job so he could pastor a church. And so he was working at nighttime and then coming home. And so when we were growing up, we didn't really know much about education either. I mean, we knew college, but we didn't know a whole lot about opportunities as far as getting a higher degree. And so when I started running and excelling and doing well in high school, I got scholarship offers and I chose to go to Oral Roberts University because it was a Christian school and it was Division I. And I felt like it was a good fit for me. And even at ORU, I can't honestly say I really loved academics or I studied much for the first couple years. I went to class. I was always a good kid. I was held up a lot in high school as kind of being the one who did things the right way. I would often win races and, you know, have a lot of scriptures that I could do all things through Christ that strengthens me. And
I'm sure that's what that text was written for.
It was written for me to win my race.
Exactly.
Yes, and not anybody else. Totally.
Yeah.
So I think there was always this faith that got intermixed in performance, I guess, is the point. So when I got to ORU, that kind of continued. I fell in love with psychology my junior year of college, and there was a professor named Dr. Bill Bucher who taught a class that really captured me, and I began to want to understand that more. And meanwhile, I was competing and doing well and qualified for the NCAA championships and ran at that, but I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I felt this pressure that I was really, in my mind, my calling was to win a medal, right? And
in
this, Olympic medal. And in this glorious moment, I could bring, you know, more people to know Jesus. And I think that was part of that performance faith arc that was being created within me. And so long story short, I enjoyed my time at RU. That same professor told me I really should go on to get my master's degree. And I remember thinking, well, what does that mean? And so I got my master's in marriage and family therapy. And I began to practice working with youth from high-risk neighborhoods for families of Head Start and then later at a high school. And I loved working with those kids. And there was this kind of integration of my work around sports and with these kids that became more real as a lot of the kids I worked with saw sports as a really important vehicle for them to get out of their circumstances and neighborhoods. And then what I realized when I was working with those kids in particular was I knew I was making a difference on a day-to-day basis, but there systemically, there were so many challenges. And I felt
in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. And I would visit their homes and I knew their parents and I knew the neighborhood leaders and I saw the struggle and the pain. And I knew I wanted to learn more about that process. And so I applied for one school. I first had to figure out what was a PhD compared to like a doctorate of psychology, compared to all these things. But I had great people in my life that steered me towards this program. I got into a great program at Oklahoma State and started studying the processes that these kids face emotionally when they're in these neighborhoods, and then how relationships can really be protective processes for them that lead to resilience. And I was honored to hear stories and be a part of that. And so I was at the end of my pro career at that point. After college, I would call it more of like a semi-pro. I picked up a sponsor and was still working full time, but trying to train. And I just couldn't stay healthy. And I kept getting injured. And so initially, when I went into really studying for my PhD, I didn't want to have anything to do with sports anymore. There was even some pain, I think, around it for me of never reaching my potential, which a lot of athletes experience that. And so my natural transition was to just really dive deep into another performance-oriented thing, a PhD. And I couldn't get enough. I loved it. I was studying and I was understanding and working with families and the numbers that we were collecting in our data. I saw faces to that. I saw real lives. I felt that deep sense of calling to do that work. And so I continued on that path. And really, I would say God just kept bringing me back to sports, bringing me back to sports. And so there was this connection of what happens with a lot of the youth I was working with, that really, in order to be protected, they had to be physiologically reactive to their situation often. They had to be aware of the circumstances at these very heightened levels. This happens to us physiologically when we're immediately threatened physically. And what kind of I started to discover and think about is also this idea that when our social self is threatened, so when we put our worth and value as human beings solely in how we perform, it triggers those same physiological mechanisms as if we're being really threatened. And we kind of bathe in these stress hormones and we deal with these issues around, am I good enough? Am I going to be evaluated negatively? How can I make sure I perform so people like me? A lot of the experiences I had, even growing up, that I had kind of integrated even into my Christian faith that were toxic. And so that's how I started to really study athletes and trying to understand what this performance-based identity does and how it prevents them from performing at their best. And then also continue to study youth in these high-risk neighborhoods. And even many of these kids, the stakes are even higher. Their performance-based identity is even higher because this avenue is their way out.
Right. And that, and sometimes one of their only ways.
Especially some of the kids who have been marginalized their whole life. But they almost get objectified as, well, you're worthy now because you can run fast or you can jump high or you can all of these things. And there was this really distinction between who they were and their value as a human being and what they do. And that became even more a part of why I study what I do is to really help youth and really all athletes recognize their worth and value. They have something to offer to this world. And that performance is not a definition of who we are. Certainly is an expression of our hard work, of the time we've put into things, our talents, our gifts, but it doesn't define us. And so that's kind of how I arrived at where I did. And personally, my own story, I think I had to come to this place where I felt broken and went through difficulty and challenge just in my PhD program and really feeling like that my performance-based identity was shattered. And then there was this beauty of God's redemption in that process that allowed me to begin to really feel his unconditional love in a new way and operate in a new way. And I always knew the gospel in my head, so to speak, but to live it out was always a challenge because I felt like I had to do everything right in order to advance God's kingdom. Mm-hmm. So
the intersection is even richer and deeper than I adequately captured earlier, because it's not only all that I said initially, but what you've just added is it's really also mapped onto a deeper part of your own story and a deeper part of this really complicated social story of how American culture has unfolded, how sports becomes both an outlet and a toxicity, even as it's a both and thing all the way along. And part of what you're trying to do is unravel some of that so that the best of what it can be without trying to make it be more than it's meant to be, in which case it then becomes toxic rather than actually helpful.
Yeah.
So just give us a story about a particular student that you may have worked with. I know that, for example, you've been a founding member of Hope Sports, which is one of the contexts in which your work has been worked. Why don't you first describe Hope Sports, put that in its setting, and then tell us a particular story about some student or young athlete that you may have worked with.
Sure. Yeah, so Hope Sports really came up. I was doing this research around athletes and performance-based identity, and I met a guy whose name is Guy East, who is a professional cyclist. And he tells his story of riding his bike. He was picked up by Lance Armstrong's team early as a youth and really a promising cyclist. And he tells a story of being in kind of countries that were poverty-stricken and lacked resources and riding his bike and coming to this place of saying, well, what am I doing? Like, what's the purpose of this? And really feeling this call to want to impact people's lives. And so when we met, it was an instant connection. And how can we create opportunity for elite athletes that wrap so much of their sense of identity and performance to serve? And by serving people, it's shaping a sense of purpose and identity in them that goes beyond just performance. Mm-hmm. And it hopefully acts as a catalyst for their lives to start to recognize meaning and connecting to something transcendent. And so that's been just over 3 years. There's been over about, I think it's over 1,000 athletes, coaches, executives from, I think, 10 different U.S. teams in professional sports. And it always is impactful. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, when I first started talking about this message to people, when I would talk to athletes, I was always struck by the quietness in the room. And I think the first couple of times I would talk about performance-based identity and I got this response, I would almost, it would hit my own performance-based kind of identity. Right. Like, well, did this sit? Was this impactful? But what I found is that this generation is starving so much for more. They're starving for purpose. They're starving for meaning. They recognize these patterns in their lives. And over the course of the weekend, we build a home over the course of a weekend for families in different countries. But they would come talk to me and tell me their stories. And incredible stories from Olympic medalists who lived in their cars because they didn't have enough money to fund their dream or their purpose. And so it became so much of who they were. It was hard to separate, but eventually that caught up with them. And there was this whole shadow side to performance of depression and anxiety and really trying to numb that pressure however they can. I remember even early on before Hope Sports, I remember working with a high school athlete who's in his junior year, had every college in America after him and was an incredible running back. And his whole family was so excited about this. This could give them an opportunity to really change his life of going and getting an education and possibly the professional ranks. And he completely blew out his knee. And I mean, in every school around, just stopped talking to him. And tragically, he just did not bounce back from that. And it was a difficult last year. And those stories still are painful for me to think about as I know these kids. And you see, that's one story of many stories. For every story that there's the triumph, for every story that there's the gold medal, there's a lot of broken dreams and broken people that through the process. And so I think, you know, I'm continuing to be motivated by these stories that I hear and see in research and also in my work with athletes.
Let's take an example like the sometimes near obsession that exists over what's simply referred to as soccer parenting.
Yeah.
So that cuts across all economic brackets.
Yeah.
It's not a sport that costs a lot, which is one of the reasons why it's as common and popular to be played as it is.
Yeah.
It's easily possible in most cases to find at least some place to play soccer, mm-hmm. even if it's not the full size field that may be needed. And the pervasiveness of that right now in especially middle class, but even lower and middle class cultures, but driven by an obsession about what it means at six to start playing soccer or five for a college career and even a professional career. That's a direct trajectory that I hear a lot of parents overtly talking about, not even subtly or by innuendo, but like, this is the trajectory that I want my kid to be on.
Yeah.
What is that about now, not just for the child, but also for the parents? What's happening?
Well, I think there's several processes. I mean, I have a four-year-old boy and an eight-month-old boy. And my four-year-old Oliver is, he's been getting into like wanting to play t-ball and do things and play soccer. And my wife's from Spain, so I don't know if he has a choice. He's going to probably have to play soccer. But even someone who studies this stuff, who sees it and understands it in parenting. And I remember one day we were outside and the t-ball was set up and he was, taking whacks at the ball and his form was completely off, but he was laughing and having fun. But there was something in me, and I don't know what it was, that switched where I was like, okay, Oliver, come here. Let me show you how to do this, right? I think he was three at the time, maybe. Why am I showing him form at 3 years old when he's having fun? And the minute I stand by him and I kind of show him, he loses interest. And it's not fun anymore. And I think within myself, it's not a matter of having performance-based identity or not. There's a continuum of that. And I think we're always having to think about that and be aware of that. But I have to be really aware of even my unfulfilled dreams and visions of what I want for my son that come from good intentions, but they can often come from my own pain, from my own story, from the way I was parented. Sure. And I think the first thing I would say with parents that you have to ask is, who is this for? Mm-hmm. When you're pushing your child, especially before the age of 13, in this kind of specializing them in one sport and really putting then coaches around them and personal trainers. And that model has not shown to be good for kids' emotional health. And it hasn't even been shown good to lead to getting NCAA Division I scholarships or going on, which is a very small number of people who go on past that. And so I think we often are blinded by our own need for performance, and we have to be aware of that. And the other thing I would say that I worry about is when all of the interactions with the child revolve around the sport. There just becomes, if that's the social life of the family, that's everything that the family is doing, and there's no meaningful conversations outside of that, then that is also a difficult scenario for the kid, and it sets them up for this performance-based identity. I mean, there's a beauty side to it. Some of the best connections I have with my dad is him going out and throwing pitches to me or playing catch. But the conversations during that process, it often allows, sports can be a vehicle for parents to really connect with kids. But the question is, what's the goal?
And at the moment that you're describing having great connections with your dad, you're not talking about baseball specifically.
Yeah, no.
Right.
You're
talking about
exactly
whatever you want to talk about.
Exactly. Yeah.
I remember there was this moment when our kids were growing up, two boys as well, who were playing t-ball. And it was at that very, very, very early stage. They were playing on a hard court. So when the ball was hit, though there were children on all the right places, they went like lemmings running after the ball. Everyone on the whole field would go after the ball. There was nothing as wonderful as that moment in childhood where they have no idea what they're doing and they're completely lost in the ball's going that way. I must go that way, whatever that means.
Yes.
Right? So they would, and because it was a hard court, if it was hit reasonably hard, it would sometimes run a long distance before they would actually get the ball. And those were my favorite days of all the years that our kids were involved in sports. Uh-huh. Those were my favorite days. Yeah. It was partly because of what you're saying. It felt as though it was just such unmitigated play.
Yeah.
There was kind of a form, but there was no concern about the formalism of that.
Yeah.
It was more just like, this is an occasion to be in the space where we loved doing whatever this funny thing was. Oh, look, there goes the ball. Let's go after the ball, right? And it felt as time went on and they grew and went to become involved in different sports. And ultimately, both of them became rowers, which was really good for them because they weren't ball sport guys. But what was also interesting about that was that it was such a tightly controlled sport because everything was about the exactitude of every stroke and
yeah.
so forth, that in a certain way, it felt like play had completely gone.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we were just into the best form.
Right.
So sadly, while I loved actually their success at rowing, I also felt like it was a sad loss because play had gone out the window. Now yeah. we were just trying to win or achieve yeah. or perform. And it does, as you say, put on the line so many issues about identity, particularly as all that's emerging
yeah.
in teenage years.
Yeah. I mean, the joy that you see, like when children play and they really love playing sports or whatever the activity is, when they're lost in that, when they're immersed in that, we can all connect to that moment, whatever it is in our life, when we feel we are in that flow of that moment of this using our giftings and our talents and we're really enjoying it. That's worship to me. That's one of the most beautiful things to witness. It's incredible. But what can often happen is the gift can shift to a burden mm-hmm. and the joy can now shift to anxiety mm-hmm. that I have to maintain. And mm-hmm. and as the stakes get higher, the lows are lower than the highs are higher. And so I think we have to really start to think about performance in general, but also in sports and say, well, what is it intended for? That has to do with our giftings. And what do those mean? Is our giftings, I will say this often, that, you know, I don't cringe because I think that it's coming from a bad place, but I cringe when I hear athletes say that all glory goes to God after a win or a victory. The reason why I cringe is because I think this really starts to set up a model of what has to be done to bring glory to God's name. And does God really need our victory to bring glory to his name? Or is our giftings really, a friend of mine who does a lot of sports chaplaincy, he's been doing it for years, he always says, giftings are to bring you closer to God first, to demonstrate that God loves you unconditionally. Two, it's to enjoy, to experience the utter joy of utilizing gifts. And three, it's to connect you with others in service. And I think we often miss that. And, you know, I work with athletes broadly, and I can see in kind of settings where achievement and performance is the main focus, maybe that is outside of the Christian realm or outside of the Christian circle. What I really is a challenge is when it gets mixed into or negative emotions get baptized in a way to drive winning in the name of Jesus. And that really becomes a challenge for Christian athletes, because now if I don't win, I've let down my family, I've let down my teammates, my coach, and I've let down God. And I found that in my research of this view of God as a perfectionistic type of coach and what happens when athletes see that and how it stunts them from ever being at their best.
It also puts its finger on a lot of the roles that coaches play in establishing the culture of a given team and the child's own particular experience. I mean, I certainly had coaches that were some of the most noble and amazing people that I've ever known. And I've had coaches that were exactly the opposite.
Yes.
Some of the people that I probably least respected, even when they were my coach, let alone in retrospect, even more, it feels. So it's interesting how parents and mm-hmm. coaches and kids themselves actually interact in creating a lot of this. Then you have the wider circle of professional sports and the economics that's wrapped around sports and the glamour that's associated with sports that makes it just overheats the whole experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that it's going to be your choice as a parent to have your children then be involved early in organized sports?
I think for me, it's going to be exposing them to a lot of different things, not just sports, music, art, and really being aware of what they enjoy. And do I want my kids to be involved with sports? I think part of me really does, and part of me is a little bit afraid of it. The beauty of sports for me is, you know, my best friends still to this day are people who I ran with. I still am connected to them. I think competition can be an incredible thing for people because it can bring out your best. I remember moments of facing people and running against people who were better than me. And just by competing with them, it allowed me to go further and push further. And so I think competition can be an important thing. It's a part of our society, too. I think there's the continuum of like the participation ribbons and not keeping score, and then the overly kind of competitive environments. And I think there's probably something in the middle of those two that's mm-hmm. important for kids. And the challenge as a parent is, even if you're doing it right at home, many kids spend hours and hours with teammates and coaches that are socializing them as well. And having to be aware of the voices that are being internalized by that, by your child around performance is daunting at mm-hmm. times. And coaches, I've had the same experience, amazing coaches that really loved me and I knew it and cared about me and I knew it. And it compelled me to work harder. Mm-hmm. And then coaches who would try to motivate out of fear because mm-hmm. that's how they were motivated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And remember that coaches at the elite level, their worth and values based on how their athletes perform. And so it can be a very cutthroat thing for them in colleges and universities. And so it's hard. It can be challenging for coaches when I work with them and talk to them. How do I create a healthy emotional mm-hmm. climate for kids to mm-hmm. thrive, for elite athletes to thrive in their performance and in emotional mm-hmm. health? It's a mm-hmm. challenge.
I'm Mark Laverton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. I remember I've been this tall, 6'2", since I was 12. We thought I was going to go through the roof, so I was relieved when I stopped growing at 6'2". And it meant that basketball was a pressure, which I gave into but never really liked the sport and always felt like it was something I was forced to play because I was so much taller than everyone else that was around me. The sport that I ended up becoming more committed to later was track and especially hurdles. And again, that's where my legs were an advantage over other kids because I could hurdle at a younger age, especially high hurdles, at a younger age than other kids would. And going back to what you're saying about the peer relationships, I remember I was a seventh grader when there was this guy named Fernando Figueroa who was the lead hurdler for our junior high school. And he was Mr. Cool as far as I and everyone else in the school, I think, was considered. And I remember him giving me the nod, like I was the guy that was going to become his replacement when he left, right? And what was significant about that at the time is that it was an example of how sports performance created an opportunity for affirmation, which included the developmental affirmation mm-hmm. of feeling like here was this older guy who thought that I could actually do this sport that I knew he could do extremely well. So there was this sort of intangible affirmation that mm-hmm. came through something that was embedded in the interaction that would only have happened if you'd been in that setting, right? Yeah. I probably wouldn't have necessarily known him otherwise. He was 2 years older. There was we weren't taking classes together. There wasn't a connection.
Yeah.
And so much of sports has to do with that sort of subtle and implicit interaction that's part of a social community.
Yeah.
And I think especially for kids, like some of the kids that you work with who live in contexts where their social reality can be so pressured by poverty, by crime, by single parents and the dynamics of single parent homes, many, many challenges like that. How do you see the economics affecting the way that you see performance and identity related? You've said a little bit already, but I'm just curious.
With sports in particular, Time Magazine did a big story on youth sports, I think it was a couple months ago, of the billion-dollar business it is. And I think one of the great losses that could occur if youth sports starts to be a place where only the privileged can and resourced can compete is, well, first, I think we'll lose out on a lot of incredible performers, but we will also lose that ability to connect with people that are different than you. Mm-hmm. And one of the beauties of sports, I think, that was for my life, and also when I was working as a counselor and coaching, is it brought together kids from different backgrounds, from very different places, and they started to know each other's stories because you have to know that person in order to really be able to be cohesive with them, even in an individual sport like track and field, that it has a team dynamic to it. And I remember when I would start to get these kids to come out for the cross-country team and track team and just seeing those connections start to happen, that even in the hallways, especially at first, some of the kids that would come run on a team, connect with the team, in the hallways, they still would kind of be in their separate silos. But as you start to see that break down, there's just such a beauty to seeing how sports can work in that mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we have to think of sports as, for youth in particular, as being for everybody. Mm-hmm. And it does hold so much potential for creating self-confidence and competence and connection. But just like anything else, it can really be taken over by kind of greed and the economics of it. And the amount of money people pay for their kids to do private lessons and things of that nature, it can create a big division. And even, you know, here in Pasadena, you can see the difference. You can see the difference between the city leagues and the leagues that don't have bats or gloves versus the teams that come in with every kid has a bat, every kid has a ball. And I think we have to think of how can we begin, what can we do to help create an environment for all kids to be able to engage in. And so this is being done around the world, too. I have a friend in Germany who does this with the German nationals and refugee children who are coming in and really creating this environment through soccer. He played for Germany for their World Cup team. And so the power that's there and the potential is there is incredible. But again, it's for what goal? What is the goal of that sport? And when it gets tainted by performance only, we miss the beauty of it. And so I think sports can transcend economics, transcend socioeconomic statuses. It can transcend a lot of barriers, racial ethnic dynamics. Barriers. But it won't do it alone. Mm-hmm. It takes intentionality. And so
So let's pour in on that part. What is it that unlocks that difference between performance that's creative and useful and positive and team building and identity developing in appropriate ways from those things becoming toxic? What, when you work with Hope Sports or when you work with individual teammates that I know that you've worked with on Olympic teams and other sports, how do you try to help unlock that difference between the toxic performance orientation and one that's healthier?
Mm-hmm. So for athletes individually, we'll often think about and talk about purpose. And purpose is a concept in developmental psychology that's been studied a lot. And purpose, it's also used a lot. And so it's important to distinguish what I'm talking about with purpose. And purpose involves three things. It first involves something that's personally meaningful to you, and it has an aim or a goal. But the third part is really important, and that is that it makes a contribution to something greater than yourself. And this shouldn't really surprise us that when people have those three dynamics in their lives, that there is a connection to a sense of my worth and value that's bigger than just performance. And, and of course, the gospel really, when we're working in the Christian setting, is the gospel really is what infuses that purpose and meaning. The meaning comes from being called before the foundations of this world and God's love and his unconditional love. And we're able out of that to serve people and express his love. For athletes who are not of Christian faith, I think it's just the closest thing to the heart of the gospel is when we're serving. And I think that these athletes find a lot of meaning in that. And that creates a more solid foundation. I think it's not the pursuit of excellence that I think is the issue. I think it's what drives it. I think it's
why
what,
you're pursuing
exactly.
Excellence.
And I think that goes all the way back to the garden story too, of always this need for more, that we can have that tendency to want just more performance. If I just can accomplish this or that, instead of really just coming from this healthy sense of identity and worth. And so I think that purpose is really important. I think relationships are critical. It's hard to overstate the importance of relationships in developmental psychology and also even in performance. We just do better connected. Our brain works better. We deal with pain better. We can approach challenge better. Study after study has shown this. And we shouldn't be surprised that we're wired for relationship. And so many times athletes, as they get into their, that when performance-based identity starts taking over, they cut off meaningful relationships to focus, right? And they're cutting off a very source of what they need in order to deal with the ups and downs. And so purpose and relationships become really important. And then that sense of self worth and value. What do you value? When you get down to when I work with athletes, and I really press them to what do they value in life? What always emerges is more transcendent things. I value my family and connection to them. I value making an impact on my neighborhood. I value friendship or loyalty. And when you work in that paradigm, it starts to create a motivation that's coming from a different place and helps them kind of replace fear of failure with this more purpose-based identity.
So really, in a way, it's recovering what's already in them, but has gotten wrongly attracted.
Absolutely.
It sort of goes back to what the medievalists used to talk about the problems of desire.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
if disordered desire is part of the way that our life gets skewed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what we think the good life will be often that we put out there, and we think that if we can just, the means of getting there are justified by the result. So I don't have to focus on the here and now. As long as I get this goal, it will justify everything I've been through. But by that time, people are often left in shambles and trying to figure out who they are and what's meaningful in this life.
So I'm personally finding the research that's being done about brain injuries in football to be an example of, in a way, a situation that we were in decades ago regarding smoking, where we knew that we had terrible results, but the culture basically ignored it.
Yeah.
Until finally we couldn't ignore it anymore. It's still allowable, but it is now clear what a danger it is. Likewise, it seems to me in football that evidence is already now in that it is as damaging as it appears to have been. It doesn't mean that it's like cancer and smoking. It's not 100% correlation, but it's an extremely high correlation. And there's a strong sense that the culture then has this tension now built into it, where on the one hand, I've been reading that there's diminishing attention being given to the NFL, partly because of people being turned off by brain injuries and the abuse of athletes. On the other hand, this addiction to sort of the nature of football, it's the kind of aggressiveness of the culture, the attraction of that competition, the tailgate, and everything else related to the whole event. So it's sort of like we're straddling now a crisis that we haven't yet figured out how it's going to go. Some people say, I think football will just gradually diminish. Other people say, no, the equipment will just get better. Do you have any opinion about that? And I'm asking this not around that as an outcome. I'm asking it really about what is the mechanism that's at work and why we resist letting go of football.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it is a cultural phenomenon. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who get lost in that Sunday event, that Saturday event, that, you know, college football is in some ways just as big, or if not bigger now. And I think that what can happen is when we get lost in that kind of that moment or the event, and there's almost becomes a blurred line between the fans and the players in this way. But I think what can happen is we can then objectify the players as if they're not real people. And I think that when you begin to objectify people, you can do all kinds of harm to them and justify it. And that's the history, you know, of course of the world, but especially of the United States. I think that when we talk about taking an honest look at brain injury, it can be really difficult to change the world of sport around this billion-dollar business. And I also think that the complexities of it are probably much greater than it can be for people who on the outside say, well, they just need to stop playing football. So I think there is a challenge in there somewhere that it's hard to figure out. The way my work intersects with that I see is important is I think when we're blinded by performance-based identity within the team culture, we can make really bad decisions, either personally, if I'm driven that I have to perform to earn my worth, even if I'm feeling dazed in any way. And I know within the football culture, especially, there's often people who will say they won't report their symptoms because they know that a protocol is going to be in place and they have to sit out a certain amount of time. So you want to just keep pushing through, which then increases the odds of getting injured more. Or even a coach might be blinded to wanting to see what's going on, or trainers. And so I think we have to start with the human that is in the system. And going all the way down to youth league, I mean, I played tackle football in the Midwest at like 8 years old. I didn't know how to tackle. We just put on pads and went at each other. And certainly now we know better than that. So there has to be some protocols in protecting the vulnerable and people who, you know, when we're making decisions about our kids that become a challenge. And it's hard. I work with a lot of people who play football and who love football. And I think there's other sports too. I mean, for instance, water polo has a high rate of concussions and people don't talk about that as much. So I think we have to be aware when we talk about football that it brings up a whole lot of other things as well. So I don't know what's going to happen to football, but certainly we're at an intersection where more and more things have to happen in order to safeguard the players.
I think part of my assumption is that there's ways that football still taps into some core identity issues in American culture, which makes it seem like an addiction that will be extremely hard to actually surpass and to surrender ultimately.
Yeah.
So I assume that it will continue.
Yeah.
But it will continue under means that have yet to be decided.
Yeah.
And some of those may be technological. Some of those may be rule-based. Some of those may be training-based.
Yeah.
But there's something about the ferocity of football that fits the personality of American culture in a way that is different even than rugby or water polo, which are popular sports, but much smaller in their global range than the dominance of something like U.S. football is.
Yeah.
So let's turn to some of the areas that are swirling around us today in our culture, whether it has to do with sports and race or sports and political protests. You know, I do think that one of the interesting things about the football thing is that it does follow an interesting narrative line, which is that we have all these rules around inappropriate tackling for quarterbacks who are almost all white.
Right.
And we do not have the same, anything like the same protocols for usually an almost all black line.
Yeah.
Right?
And
so,
or running backs.
Or running backs. Or, yeah, I mean, it goes
on,
there's
a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah. It's just an amazing thing that actually does seem to fall out along some pretty interesting racial lines, which is part of the objectification that I think you're getting at. And because football is one of the main, football and basketball, I think, are mostly the two urban sports, at least, that inner city black kids feel like are the way out.
Yeah.
It's really complicated.
It is. And I mean, it also adds that, I mean, that context shapes the narrative around the whole protest and kneeling.
Absolutely. Totally.
And I think that that's, you know, it's almost, it really is, to me, is the epitome of a performance-based identity. When you say to somebody, look, exactly what was said to LeBron James, shut up and dribble.
Right.
Right? Is just be an object.
Right.
Entertain us.
Right.
Don't be a human.
Right.
Don't care about things that you've faced your whole life and the marginalization
and
that you've experienced.
Kneel. Yeah. Right.
And be, you know, and I think that is often lost in the conversation. And it's easier for white people to talk about that in such ways to say, oh, well, they shouldn't be doing this. They should just be doing it, because they don't have that history of experience. I think, too, one of the passions I feel is to help athletes form a sense of meaning and purpose. And so when I see athletes kneel, what I think of is they're connecting to something greater than themselves. There's a purpose and meaning there. And what a loss of opportunity is for the NFL to not tap into that, to say, this is actually really great. They're caring about something that then is formative for their own character and their own virtue and how they interact in the world and do good for the world. And that is so short-sighted to me.
So yesterday, I don't know who this guy is. I just don't follow these things, but there was this guy who apparently completed more passes now than's ever been completed in the NFL yesterday. And they interviewed him. I don't know anything about this person, but he was really distinctly articulate, thoughtful, humble, he did not seem to be achieving. And when he was describing it, how this happened, he said, you know, it's easy to say a quarterback threw the most passes, but it entirely depends on the line. It entirely depends on all the receivers. It entirely depends on everybody. So he said, it's just absurd to think that I'm the one who gets the title when in fact it's this much larger picture, which is exactly right. But which also felt to me as I was listening to him, wondering if he was a Christian, frankly, but also wondering if he was so calm about it, not testosterone about it, that it felt to me like he was grounded, as you're saying, in simply a larger reality. Yeah. So here was this moment that really gives him the title of beyond any quarterback that's ever played in the NFL.
Right.
A pretty amazing thing to say about any given achievement.
Yeah.
And that's his outcome.
Well, you can see the difference with athletes like that. And I'll just tell you, even in the data I have, it's astounding. I mean, I've collected a lot of data in my life in academics, but around these issues, I've never seen relationships, the strength of relationships between variables so strong and so typical of what I would expect around performance-based identity and, and purpose and meaning. I'm just fully convinced. And I really believe that healthier, emotionally healthier, people with healthy sense of identity perform better. But there's not a single study that's really looked at this in a rigorous way. And so I think
that's the long-term project.
Long-term,
that you're looking at.
Yeah. And seeing how is this, can we really shape this in children early so that they can be at their best and be like the athlete who they interviewed to really be for it to really be kind of this beautiful, almost, I mean, this is probably a stronger word than I should say, but it's almost like you've been in, you see these almost sacramental moments, like these moments that are so special, they transcend everything.
Right.
And when it comes from a place of health, and I think that comes from a good God. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there's something about that that's beautiful.
Right. There's this book that a friend of mine has written that you'll be hearing more about because we'll have him here and he will do things for the school in various ways, but he's coming at New Year's as well, called The Orchid and the Dandelion.
Okay, yeah,
and
yeah.
I've mentioned this before. Yes. And his, you know, the core of it is that what shows up in studies of healthcare is that there's roughly 5% of the population that they, as in these longitudinal studies, are calling orchids. And if they are children that are given the right attention, mm-hmm. which can be variable but has certain key components that have to be provided, if those are given, they can achieve at the highest 5% and have the best physical health. Mm. But if they don't, they are almost surely going to be the bottom 5%.
Yeah.
So it's not like they end up in the middle somewhere.
Yeah.
It is an extreme. And you're either, if you're that kind of a child, you have this capacity to either super achieve and be extremely healthy but fragile like an orchid, or to just completely collapse and have some of the worst pathology. And they can measure the indicators of that 3 hours after birth. And 35 years later, they can see the same material basically in the biology of these children.
Yeah.
But what affects whether they've gone up or down has to do with everything about the environment, the context of people that have influenced them, the way that they've been given appropriate attention, the kind of identity that they've formed, the community that surrounds them. I mean, so many things, just things that we would presume would be powerful. But but it is a remarkable study and it plays into, because some of the people that you see hyper-achieving in athletics are the 5%. They are the they are the orchid children.
Absolutely.
Who, through whatever means,
ended
up getting either artificially and in that sense toxically, ultimately it will be their undoing.
Right.
Even if they've been high achievers.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So who was the player that, was it some quarterback I read in the last 6 months who'd already retired like 3 years ago and he's now saying, I'm coming back?
Like, well, I haven't seen I mean, it happens all the time.
Right, because you just cannot let
go
of it.
You can't let go. I mean, imagine your whole life is built. Imagine your whole life is built around this thing, and all of a sudden, you're done. One day, you wake up the next day, and slowly, remember, because the thing, the problem is it's not that your worth and value is just based on your performance. It's based in your today's performance.
Right.
So our greatest athletes are forgotten 6 months, 7 months, 8 months later, and that's really hard for them.
Right.
It's really hard for them to say, well, what do I have to offer now? Nobody cares about me anymore. And so you do find that
and
painful.
And that's been fed in a cycle.
Oh, absolutely.
That's part of the biochemistry
from the time they're
that you're
little. Yeah, right? Absolutely.
The feedback loop.
Yeah, yeah. We found the same as, you know, even with genetic markers of kids who are just more sensitive to the environment.
Right.
So whatever environment they're in, that's going to shape them
in
more ways than other children. And it really creates this responsibility for community, right? Like we're responsible for helping these kids.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So, yeah.
Well, I have to just say, Ben, it's just a great thrill to me that you are doing this work. And it feels to me like it, existing at the intersection of sports, culture, and faith around issues of identity is about as important a place as a person could be at this moment in our culture.
Yeah.
And I'm just very, very grateful for your work and thankful for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.